Fishermen used to rely on good luck to haul in the big catch, but when they began relying on information instead of luck, they almost caught all the fish in the sea. That leads us to ask, can we catch fish so there will be fish left to catch?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1314th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, given the technologies of the information age, we the people have become very adept at catching fish. In fact, if we could get away with it, like we got away with killing off all the buffalo, we would probably go out and catch all the fish in the sea. And why not? There are a lot of hungry people that need to be fed, and there is a lot of money to be made. But we simply can't get away with it. If we do catch all the fish in the sea, there will be no more fish left to catch. Who then will feed all those hungry people? And how are we going to make any money fishing? And so some of us are taking steps to establish sustainable fisheries. That is simply a fishery where fishermen can go back year after year and catch fish, but only to the extent that the fish they do not catch can reproduce themselves and the fishery. Certainly not all of us are taking those steps. And if you think about the business of setting up sustainable fisheries, it's a lot like the business of managing greenhouse gases. Some communities will eliminate all their wood-burning fireplaces. Other communities will build coal-burning power plants. But that is our world, and it does lead us to ask, can we catch fish so there will be fish left to be caught? Well, here to help us catch an answer, we have Nicholas Sullivan, who is a senior research fellow at Tufts University and the author of The Blue Revolution, Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age. Nicholas, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, a pleasure to have you aboard. Are you a fisherman?
Not so much. I was when I was younger. I used to catch scup in Rhode Island and tautog and things like that. But around where I live in Massachusetts now, we do some blue fishing and bass fishing in the summer. But I'm not a big recreational fisher, no.
Okay. All right. Well, do you eat fish then?
I eat fish. Last night I had some branzino, in fact.
But then if you eat fish, you're a fisherman, I think.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Well, it seems like our world is trying to make the transition from fishing for fish to farming for fish. By that, I mean the fish of the sea are being penned up in fish farms, and even our free-swimming fish populations are being corralled by laws, rules, and regulations. Is there any Wild West left for the fishermen and women of the world?
Yes. The Wild West is basically on the high seas. The high seas being the 40% of the world's ocean that is outside the territorial zones of countries. Every country has a 200-mile limit, exclusive economic zone. And beyond that, it's the high seas. And the high seas are not very well regulated. I mean, there are UN regulations and mandates and resolutions, but it's pretty hard to enforce them because it's such a vast territory. And the other thing I would say is that there are some countries where even within their exclusive economic zone, there definitely is overfishing. And there's even raiding by other countries that are coming in to some of the west coasts of Africa in particular, the west coast of South America, tend to get kind of marauders and pirates.
Well, we see that China seems to be one of the countries that's doing a lot of marauding. And we see that some of the smaller countries are actually sinking those Chinese fishing boats with gunfire. So there's a lot, I guess it really is the Wild West in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know, I think it was last fall, or maybe it was a year ago, the Chinese squid boats are off the Galapagos National Park, which is, you know, kind of off limits to fishing, but they had lighting up the sky with lights to attract squid and taking squid and who knows what else out of the water. The Ecuadorian Navy couldn't deal with it. They called in the U.S. Coast Guard to come down, and they drove the Chinese ships down to Chile. The Chileans drove them down to Argentina. I think the Argentines did sink one or two of those boats. So, yeah, there's that kind of stuff is going on. You know, one of the issues with that kind of high seas or illegal fishing is that there are a lot of countries have, or I should say a handful of countries, have subsidies to provide distant water fleets with the wherewithal to go out for weeks or months at a time. The business would not be profitable without the subsidies, but there's $35 billion in global subsidies. The World Trade Organization has been trying to outlaw those for 20 years, and we're on the verge of doing so last fall, and their conference or a meeting that was supposed to be kind of the final vote was postponed due to COVID. So that's still an open question. But the subsidies are a huge problem. And if they were removed and it could be enforced, it would really change the nature of the game, because there would not be the free market reason to go out and spend all that fuel and time and labor on the high seas.
It's almost like economic warfare.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I think, you know, and you're right. And it's, you know, when I got into this book, and my question initially was, where are the fish, like, as you posited at the beginning, where are the fish going to come from to feed the world? I was aware of illegal IUU, you know, illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing, but I had no idea the extent of it. And the estimates are that 30% of the fish that are caught are kind of IUU, illegal, unreported, unregulated. And that is just a huge sinker on the world resource, you know?
You tell a wonderful story about one fisherman that has a whole fleet, and I'd love to pick that story up later because it's illustrative of that problem for sure. But a quick note about you. You're right there on the coast, and your book, Blue Revolution, focuses on that northeast coast fishery of the United States, which is traditionally a magnificent fishery, but not so much anymore. So tell us a little bit. Let's go up to the Grand Banks and talk about the cod fishery of the Grand Banks, because way back when, in the 1600s, when the Europeans first started fishing that fishery, they wrote that there are so many fish, it's almost impossible to row a boat through them.
Right.
Amazing, yeah. To even think about the fish being that prolific. What happened?
And I think that actually even the earlier than that, in about 1000 AD, Basque fishermen from Spain were fishing off the coast of the Grand Banks and the coast of the U.S., and keeping it a secret from the rest of the world.
Right.
Well, obviously, it's been overfished. I mean, Daniel Pauly, who's a great marine biologist at the University of Vancouver, puts the kind of the biomass, the level of the biomass, or the, you know, volume of the cod stock at about 1% of its, you know, 1600s or maybe even 19th century. I'm not sure which. I can't remember. But, yeah, so it's been much reduced by overfishing. And now it's been, you know, in 1992, if you look at Newfoundland, if you look at kind of a jagged line going up and down over the 70s and 80s, 92 just drops off the table. They shut down the fishery, 30,000 people out of work overnight, more or less. And but the same thing was happening in the U.S., but the U.S. kept fishing at reduced levels with more restrictions. But what became obvious, or more obvious, you know, in about 2015, is that warming waters are also now having a huge impact on cod and their ability to survive from a juvenile to an adult to spawn. They're smaller. The females are having fewer babies. And so overfishing is clearly the driver. But as NOAA Fisheries will now say, an equally important co-driver is climate change. And the Gulf of Maine is warming seven times faster than the rest of the world's oceans.
Wow. Now, to help people understand why the area of the Northeast Atlantic, particularly, you know, the northeastern United States and Canada and Newfoundland have been traditionally such, lucrative fisheries, what is about the geography there that makes it so prolific there?
Yeah, great question. And it is the confluence of two major ocean currents, the Labrador Current coming down from the Arctic, mixing with the Gulf Stream coming up from the south. And that dynamic interaction wells up nutrients from the bottom of the ocean, feeds the phytoplankton, which are at the bottom of the food chain. And the phytoplankton on Georgia's banks, say, the kind of hallowed fishing grounds 90 miles off the coast of Cape Cod, phytoplankton there are three times more energy, have more chemical energy or larger than phytoplankton elsewhere in the world. And it's that, you know, bottom of the food chain that feeds the fish larvae and the juveniles and the forage fish and so forth. So it really is the intersection of those two currents. And what's happened recently is with the warming of the Arctic, the Labrador Current is losing a bit of its power, and the Gulf Stream is moving further up into the Gulf of Maine. And that accounts for the incredible accelerated warming of the water.
And also, the banks themselves have something to do with it too, don't they?
I think because of, the shallowness, because when the shallowness means the phytoplankton, they are kind of drifting at the top layer of the ocean, but they're closer to the bottom because it's shallower, sunlight is penetrating, and phytoplankton actually have chlorophyll, and through photosynthesis, you know, they absorb sunlight and carbon dioxide and emit oxygen. So if you get, and Georgia's Bank is also shallow, so you get a lot of sunlight penetrating and the nutrients are close to the top. You know, it's a recipe and for a vital ecosystem.
And thus the profundity of the fishery. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Nicholas Sullivan, Senior Research Fellow at Tufts University and the author of The Blue Revolution. So when we come back, let's look at what a blue revolution looks like. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
This is the Food Chain, and we are talking about a very big food chain, the world's fisheries, and with a particular focus on the Georges and the great Grand Banks of the Northeast continental North America, which has been feeding the world for a long, long time, since the year 1000, I guess. Wow. That is a long time. But we've fished it out, and we've done so largely by virtue of our industrialization of fishing. Nicholas Sullivan, you talk a lot about fishing in the era of the information age. What do you mean by that?
Well, I start this book in the 90s, where the overfishing was kind of at its peak, and since then, starting in the year 2000, things have really begun to change. And with the scallop industry, which was kind of down and out in the mid-90s, the change was that scientists and fishermen and regulators collaborated to do a number of very interesting scientific surveys, including dragging underwater cameras along the bottom that would take photos of the scallop beds, beam them up to the pilot house. And so that kind of a very scientific evidence-based approach opened up scallop beds, led to a kind of rotational system like farmers on land would use with crops. And the scallop industry went from being kind of dead in the water in the mid-90s to now being a $530 million industry, mostly out of New Bedford, but up and down the East Coast. And the other thing I would say is that in the other part of it is a policy change, which occurred in 2010, when the regulators went from a days at sea regime, you could fish X number of days per year, depending on the stock or species. They went to an annual catch limit, and divvied up into quotas by boat, by captain. And that really has restricted the catch and protected the stocks. So since 2000, 47 stocks in the Northeast U.S. that were overfished have now been rebuilt. So it, even though the cod is kind of in decline, and the flounder as well, there are tons of ground fish. There are more ground fish than there were 25 years ago. So that is kind of a good news story, and I'm trying to kind of flip the narrative and tell the positive side of the story, because all we hear is the dire end of world story.
Well, good. There is good news, but not so much for the cod at this time. What made us so prolific? What turned us into such prolific fishermen was, I think, the industrialization of fishing. Would you give us a thumbnail on that whole scenario?
Yeah, well, I mean, fishing over the last two centuries has gotten more and more sophisticated, right, with new technologies, but it really picked up post-World War II when a lot of warships or Navy boats were turned into fishing craft, and trawlers went deeper and deeper. I mean, the trawl nets went deeper and deeper, and that is really what, and it just basically accelerated from the 50s right up through the 90s. And some countries like Iceland really put the clamps on earlier, like in the 90s. In the 80s, and New Zealand as well. U.S. is a bit later. But I'd say about half the world now is pretty has pretty strong fisheries management, you know, in terms of restricting catch and protecting their waters against intrusion. Like, even Indonesia is very protective of its waters, and they're out, their Coast Guard is out patrolling for foreign ships.
And, you know, when you say trawling, I suspect there are a lot of people who don't know what a trawler does. Would you describe that?
Well, a trawl net is just a large net, which is open at one end and closed at the other end. The other end, the closed end, is called the cod end, because it used to be to catch cod. So is that you trawl, and there are midwater trawlers that kind of don't go to the bottom, and then there are bottom trawlers for ground fish living at the bottom. And you just drag the net either to the mid layer of the ocean or the bottom of the ocean, and fish get pulled in through the open end and get stuck in the cod end, which is closed, and then it's the net is lifted up on the boat and opened up, and you've got all the fish there.
Mm-hmm. Does not and sound like a very selective way of catching fish.
No, well, a good point. I was just going to say that, so the problem with that, of course, is that you might have gotten a lot of cod or haddock or whatever you're out for, but you're also getting a lot of other stuff that it was called bycatch, as often unwanted fish. But and those fish were largely then thrown back overboard. Very few of them survived, I think. And it was in 96 when the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which has governed U.S. fisheries since 1976, was rewritten to protect bycatch. And so now, interestingly enough, the cod and haddock swim together. They're cousins. And haddock are very abundant. Cod are not very abundant. So if you're fishing for haddock, you have to avoid cod. As a consequence, they're saying now that fishermen are only catching 10 to 15% of the haddock abundance because they're trying to avoid the cod, which is a bycatch, and they're, you know, they don't want to be fined or penalized. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a policy change, and which has led to a behavioral change because there's been no choice but to, or you'll be fined and, you know, arrested and so forth.
So for every country to protect its fishing resources and to make them sustainable, because that is the objective, right, to have a fishery where fishermen can go out and fish and still have fish left to catch next time they go out fishing. So to build that world, we have to develop lots of rules and regulations and whatnot. But people find ways around those. And you told this wonderful story about a fisherman who...
Here, Carlos Rafael.
Yeah, Carlos Rafael.
Yeah, nicknamed the Codfather, New Bedford fisherman. Before I get to him, I'll just say one thing about the Magnuson-Stevens Act started in 1976. And the bedrock principle of that is fishing any stock to its maximum sustainable yield. So that's always been the principle that has guided U.S. fisheries. But the problem has been, as you just noted, that if you fish one stock to its maximum sustainable yield, you might fish other stocks beyond their sustainable yield. So anyway, the Codfather, who was arrested and did 4 years in jail, a very successful Portuguese immigrant fisherman in New Bedford, owned 45 or so boats, scallop boats and ground fish boats. And he used to, in the days when the cod were declining, he was catching a lot of cod, but he was calling it haddock, which was abundant. So he was mislabeling fish. He was selling it not through normal channels. He had his own processing plant, so he didn't have to really go through the authorities. He would send fish from New Bedford down to New York to the Fulton Street Fish Market, get cash in exchange without any paperwork and so forth. So it was an illegal operation, and he was mislabeling fish, not reporting income, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it was a very big deal when he was arrested, indicted, and convicted in 2017, I believe. And it has led to a real shift in the industry, I'd say, because it's made everyone aware of the fact that they were really not on the up and up all along, because he certainly wasn't the only person doing that, you know. And so I think it's really it's part of the kind of post-industrial shift, I think, is okay, we've got to really straighten out, we got to be transparent, we got to record, we got to report, we got to have monitoring of what we're doing and so forth.
All of those regulations that fishermen curse, just like everybody else curses them,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Well, one thing you made, you talked about vertical integration.
Right. And that's what the Codfather had, because he had his own boats, caught his own fish, but he also processed it himself and distributed it. So it didn't, you know, go through other hands where there would have been kind of a system that would have identified the mislabeling.
And you talk about how the fish goes through 13 hands from whoever catches it to whoever eats it.
Yeah, often that has been the case. But there, again, there's been a very positive shift in that there's been more selling direct, producer to consumer, although not all fishermen are going to want to do that because it is like running another business. But there are fish processors who are doing that. And so they're, you know, taking out a lot of those middle men and those hands in between. And they're introducing blockchain traceability of fish from boat to plate, which is kind of a bit of a jumbled effort at the moment because it's new, but
right. It's
the next big thing, I think, really, because people do want to know where their fish come from. They do want to know if it's sustainably caught, legally caught, and so forth, and how it's handled. Because, you know, a fish that goes through 13 pairs of hands or travels 5,000 miles, which is what slow fish says about the average fish on your plate in the U.S., you know, that's not really a fresh piece of fish, right?
So I wonder about that with respect to your scallops that I eat here on the West Coast, because I'm pretty sure they're coming from the East Coast.
Right. But they're, you know, probably flash frozen and sometimes on the boat or shortly after landing. The scallop industry is very sophisticated, has very, you know, state-of-the-art processing and so forth. And flash freezing, two things have happened. One is super chilling systems. This is not so much for scallops, but maybe it is, where you keep ice slurry at, say, 31 degrees, fish freeze at 28. So you keep the fish fresh, you know, before you land them. And there's flash freezing systems where you just kind of, once you've processed them, they're flash frozen. And so that really locks in kind of the natural freshness.
Well, I often think that, flash frozen fish are a lot of times superior to fresh fish that really, because as I understand it, fresh only means that it hasn't been frozen. Am I right?
Right. And it may be 10 days old or something, right? And you really would like a fish that's 7 days or less, you know, old that hasn't been frozen. There's a company called Sitka, after Sitka, Alaska, Salmon Shares, which is selling mostly salmon, but all kinds of fish from Alaska all over the country. And it is definitely flash frozen because it's got to travel a distance. But, you know, they've got, you know, you sign up for a monthly share and you get your flash frozen fish from Alaska. So that's a new trend. It's a high end thing. It's not going to feed the world necessarily, but it is a positive development for sure. Yeah.
So let's go back to the Magnuson-Stevenson Act. We here in the United States came to the conclusion that to avoid what happened to the Grand Banks, we'd have to take control somehow of our fisheries. To what extent did the Magnuson-Stevenson Act change the fisheries?
Well, the first thing it did in 1976, and the real impetus behind it was, at that point, there was like a 12-mile federal limit, and beyond that was the high seas. So in the 70s, there were factory ships from Russia and Eastern Europe off the shores of Cape Cod on George's Bank. You could see them from the shorelines. And they were just sucking up masses of fish. And the little day boats out of Cape Cod were just getting, hammered by the big ships. So the Magnuson-Stevens Act, its primary goal initially was to establish the 200-mile limit and push the foreign ships off of George's Bank and to establish the principle of maximum sustainable yield. But what happened?
So those are two big steps right there. First of all, you're claiming your turf.
Right.
Now, did everybody agree with that and say, you can have 200 miles and it's okay with me?
Yeah, well, it's now become, it was kind of enshrined by the UN in the 80s. So it's now every country has got 200 mile limit. So the United States now has more ocean territory, the second most ocean territory in the world after France. And it's got more water, more land underwater than it does above water, which is amazing. So when you talk about aquaculture, I don't know if you do want to talk about aquaculture, but the United States.
Well, we're going to take a break here in just a minute. So we'll pick up aquaculture, fish farming from that. But the two big things of Magnuson Stevens, first of all, we own this turf 200 miles from our shore. That's a big deal. And the second thing is maximum sustainable harvesting, which is to say we harvest as much as we can without messing things up, right?
Correct. And then it was rewritten in 96 to say, okay, well, there's this bycatch issue. If you're fishing one stock to its maximum sustainable yield, you may be overfishing other fish. So we've got to consider the whole ecosystem, not just an individual stock, which is, and then in the 2010 was let's go to annual catch limits for each species. Like NOAA oversees 450 species in the U.S., which is amazing.
Wow.
Right? And they don't do annual catch limits for all of those, but they do it for all of the major ones every year, which is a lot of surveying, a lot of science, and a lot of...
Of headaches for fishermen trying to keep track of it all. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Mike Lolson with Nicholas Sullivan, the author of The Blue Revolution. When we come back, I forgot to ask him, what is the Blue Revolution? Stay tuned.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale at Eniwetok, February 1944.
We got detached for some close-in shore bombardment on one of the little coral islands. From a distance, they're just little slivers of white and green separating the blue sea and sky. Somehow we found ourselves blasting away with our 5-inchers from one side of the island, while the big old battleships on the other side were booming away with their giant 16-inch rifles. Trouble was, the trajectory of their rounds was flat, so a bunch of those 16-inch shells hit that round slip of coral and ricocheted right off in our direction. You could hear them roaring past right over our head, and they didn't sound friendly at all. Captain said, "Let's get the hell out of here."
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
Come on, you watch the news. Be prepared to pay more taxes. Then if you owe back taxes or haven't filed in a few years, get ready. The IRS, the largest collection agency in the world, will be coming after you. With the power to collect taxes by any means they want to. Hey, they can freeze your bank account, your passport, even padlock your business. Oh, good times. Look, if the IRS claims you owe them $5,000 or more in back taxes and they're coming after you, don't panic. Call my friends at Get a Tax Lawyer first. Their job is to negotiate with the IRS and save you money. They're experts at it. That's all they do. And you can trust them. In some cases, they have reduced a $50,000 tax bill to less than $1,000. If you owe the IRS $5,000 or more in back taxes, call now for a free consultation.
Call 800-661-5096. 800-661-5096. 800-661-5096. That's 800-661-5096.
Are you nearly maxed out on your credit cards? It doesn't matter if you're using your credit cards for fun or to survive. At the end of the month, your statements come in, and you can either pay them or you can't. If you can't, late fees and interest rates get tacked on, and now you're struggling just to make the minimum payment due. Do you feel trapped? Am I talking to you? Good, because I personally researched some companies that can help you. They may be able to reduce your credit card balances by 50% and stop the late fees. If you qualify, please call our special debt hotline number right now for a complimentary, free 5-minute consultation. Deal with your credit card problem now before it gets much worse and put more money back in your pocket. Trust me, I've been there too. Call right now.
800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. That's 800-370-8128.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Let's go fishing. I love to go fishing. I love to eat fish. And I worry, though, that somehow we might figure out how to do to fish what we did with the buffalo. And that would be very, very distressing indeed for everybody in the world. But we've done a lot to turn those things around. And one of them is, of course, we passed laws that really govern how we go about doing our fishing. Is that, Nicholas Sullivan, part of the Blue Revolution of which you speak?
I think it is. The Blue Revolution does have, I've kind of extended the original idea of the Blue Revolution. There was in the 60s and 70s, in 80s, something called the Green Revolution, which started in Mexico and spread to
Asia. Norman Borlaug.
Yes, to increase yields of rice and grain and so forth. And I think it quadrupled them, but ended up kind of over farming and monocropping the same land and using maybe too many pesticides and fertilizers. And but then in the 80s, there was a Blue Revolution for fishing, for farm fish, mostly freshwater fish, started in India and, of course, spread throughout China, mm-hmm. which has been farming, you know, freshwater fish for centuries.
Ever.
And so I took that Blue Revolution and said, well, things are really changing. It's moving into the Western world, throughout the world. It's moving from freshwater to the ocean. And it's got new tools, new technologies, new science, and it's part of the information age. So hopefully we've learned a lot. And the Blue Revolution in India made a lot of the same mistakes as the Green Revolution. You know, they overfished. They pulled out mangrove swamps for shrimp farms. And it was not environmentally sustainable, put mm-hmm. it that way. So anyway, that's my Blue Revolution is an extension, the modern version of the original Blue Revolution.
And when you talk about the information age, you're really talking about information or data management, right?
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, the whole thing about the ocean when you're talking about farm fish, it is so, there's so much unknown about the ocean, right? So data collection has become a part of the blue economy. How do we collect data to better understand the ocean, what's going on, especially with the climate change impacts? And if you're farming fish, you know, there is very high-tech technology systems that are totally dependent on sensors and machine learning algorithms to operate those things. So, it's data and science coming to the fore, as opposed to just good old-fashioned get on a boat and go hunting.
You know, yeah, that's, there you go. The last of the hunters and gatherers, right?
Right. Well, fish is the last wild food, commercially hunted wild food in the world. So it would be nice to save it. And, you know, the other thing that's happening in that regard is there's more emphasis on getting more value out of the fish. So like 40% of most fish is thrown away, the skeleton, the head, the innards. And there's a movement started in Iceland, now spreading throughout the world, especially the United States, to find ways to utilize that kind of quote-unquote waste, turn waste into value.
Yeah, isn't one of those ways grinding up the leftovers into fish meal pellets that you feed back to fish in fish farms?
That is part of it. It's turning it into pet food or fertilizer and so forth. But a lot of the fish meal and fish oil comes from actual forage fish, like, you know, menhaden and herring and things like that. But that has also really changed because, you know, that was very upsetting to a lot of people. Well, why are we robbing Peter with forage fish to pay Paul, you know, feed other fish? And so now they're doing single cell protein you know, insect larvae, mm-hmm. and there are other ways to get protein into fish without using other fish.
Yeah, those are some of the things they want us to eat, too. Single-cell protein know. And insect powder.
Yeah.
Make your breakfast shake with them, right?
That's right, yeah. And kelp. It's the darling of the blue-green economy these days, right? And
now, kelp is a very miraculous plant, if you think about it, because it's just hanging there in seawater, which dissolves just about everything. So there are a lot of things in kelp that are very valuable to the food chain.
Right. And the other thing about kelp is it absorbs CO2. So, you know, as you know, the ocean is a great buffer for CO2, but there's a limit to how much it can buffer. So now there's some evidence, and they're doing more study on this, that if you grow shellfish and kelp in the same location, the shellfish have thicker shells and for meat. They're not fighting off the CO2, which is destroys the calcium carbonate in their shells. So it's very kind of restorative. You know, I found out recently, I heard a talk by the head of aquaculture at the Nature Conservancy, and he said that globally, 60% of all aquaculture is actually shellfish and kelp, which is amazing to me because, you know, you hear all these stories about finfish farming being so terrible, but farming is actually restorative to the ocean. And the other thing that's happening with the finfish farming is that the land-based farms, they're proliferating in New England now and parts of Europe. And I think there's some plan for California. There's one in Wisconsin and Indiana. So they're taking fish out of the water onto land into systems where you can control the environment mm-hmm. and reduce the negative environmental impacts significantly.
Well, they're doing that with just about everything, you know, even strawberries. They're building vertical farms in warehouses so that you,
right.
you don't have to mess with Mother Earth at all. You're hiding out in a warehouse someplace.
Hydroponics.
Yeah.
Well, you know, some of the fish farms are developing aquaponics, turning the water from the fish farms into combining it with aquaculture with hydroponics into aquaponics and growing greens and hemp and things mm-hmm. like that.
So lots of things to experiment with. As the Chinese have been doing the aquaponics for, you know, millenniums, so I guess we could learn a lot from how they do things. So what we're seeing is a kind of a transformation of our fisheries so that we can avoid the destruction of those fisheries. One of the saddest stories, I think, about our treatment of fisheries is the Atlantic salmon. What happened to it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's been illegal to hunt Atlantic salmon since 1948 in the U.S., And I know you can do recreational salmon fishing in Canada and Iceland and things, but commercially it's been illegal since 1948. I actually honestly don't know. I mean, some of it was overfishing, obviously, but again, there's another impact of climate change, which is affecting salmon, is that, you know, the phytoplankton we talked about earlier have less energy than they used to, which means that fish like the capelin, which is a small forage fish that salmon feed on, has less energy. So the salmon are having to exert more energy to get the energy they need, and there's less oxygen in the water. So they're in a kind of hard place. They're getting squeezed. But I don't know if, you know, well, actually, the other thing that happened with salmon is the dams that were cutting off their spawning grounds at the, you know, the headwaters of rivers. And but that's been going on for a couple of centuries, so that's not a recent phenomenon.
Well, it seems like the Atlantic salmon is somewhat emblematic of the direction of fisheries. where a fish used to be swimming in the sea, they're now swimming in farms. And that is the salmon that we tend to get almost all over the world now, is farmed Atlantic salmon, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it is. We import, I think, $4 billion, or maybe that's even an old number, so it's probably more than that, $4 billion worth of farmed salmon from, you know, Norway and Chile. And, you know, China, speaking of China and aquaculture, they have just built a farm fish ship that is twice as long as the Titanic. It's like 800 or 900 feet long, and they are farming Atlantic salmon, which is unbelievable, right? Which is not a native fish.
You mean in the ship?
Yeah, they've got all these tanks in there, and there's, you know, they're sucking in ocean water, circulating it through the tanks, and they've got, you know, 80,000 cubic meters of water, and it's a very new thing, and I kind of wonder if this really fits the post-industrial.
Well, it does. Does
talking
it,
about or it's a,
it it does because we're trying to reach for a way of making a fishery sustainable, and if
right.
you think about how you could take a ship and kind of move it through the ocean and have that fresh ocean water cycling through the, I don't know, it seems kind of far-fetched, but.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you have that take on it because I've been kind of twisting on that. So there's definitely a lot going on. And, you know, most of what Americans eat, or 65% of what Americans eat, is farmed salmon, farmed shrimp, and tuna from other parts of the world. That's why this whole local catch movement, this direct to producer to consumer movement, the community supported fisheries, all that is so great. And because it's, you know, eating fish closer to us, eating what the ocean provides, rather than saying I've got to have salmon from the other side of the world, yep. rather than fresh fish from my backyard. You know, it's
so. One of the things I always like to say is, true joy is food with its farmer's face on it. So the same could be said with fish, right? Fish with its fisherman's face on it. So,
yeah,
if you're close enough to the beach, where you can meet a fisherman, you're in business with respect to fish, and
There's a company in Boston and New Bedford called Red's Best, run by Jared Auerbach. And they're not a fisherman, but they go around to docks up and down Massachusetts and Rhode Island, collect fish of all kinds, whatever is being caught, brought in, process it, and distribute it. And one of the things they do is they're putting QR codes on all their packaging that has the story of the boat and the fisherman and the location in which it was caught. So it's not a blockchain thing, but it is a storytelling device. Mm-hmm. And it really does put exactly what you said. It puts a face on the farmer, a face on the fisherman. Because you can see the fisherman, you see the boat, you see where it was caught. It's a simple thing, but it's very powerful.
Food with its farmer's face on it, and fish with its fisherman's face on it. There you go. It's about that provenance. You know, where is my food coming from? How do they grow it? What's in it? And, you know, we've been talking about how the climate is changing the oceans and how fish are finding it harder to get the nutrition needed to sustain and grow populations. So those pieces of information are extremely valuable to my way of thinking.
Yeah.
So
you know, you talk about the provenance. One of my favorite quotes is from Barton Siever, the great seafood chef and sustainability advocate and seafood literacy advocate, who always says that seafood is the only protein that is guilty until proven innocent. And that is that people have such suspicions about seafood, and that those are the kind of the negative perceptions that I encounter when I was researching this and trying to counter them with a more positive narrative. You know?
Well, I think you described that when you talked about how, you know, the average fish goes 5,000 miles from 13 different hands. How do you know? You don't really know. Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is what we're going to dedicate this show to, the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. And that's why people are suspicious of fish, because it's far away. And if it's closer, if we can figure out how to make it closer, it's going to be better for everybody, I think.
Yeah, well, that is true. All that you said is true, except that Americans, by and large, are eating in restaurants farm shrimp and salmon from the other side of the world.
There you go.
So they say that, but they just got to have their shrimp and salmon. And
that's what we're, I guess, most comfortable with. We have to have our fish and salmon. Well, folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, this is the 1314th show. Today we're talking about fish. Can we catch fish so there will be fish left to catch? Nicholas Sullivan, Senior Research Fellow at Tufts University and author of The Blue Revolution, Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us, and let's go fishing.
Thank you very much. And just one additional note to the book. It's published by Island Press, and you can buy it from them at a 20% discount with the promo code Sullivan.
There you go. Good read. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you very much, Michael. It was a pleasure speaking with you. I love your laws of food chain.
All right. Thank you very much, everybody.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.